Hi, this is James Mercer from The Shins.
This is Shirley Manson.
This is Lowe Tullis, co-founder of The Cure.
This is Huey Lewis giving you the story behind the song.
The Story Behind the Song is back with an exciting second season. We peel back the layers on music's most iconic hits with legendary artists like The Killers, Heart, The B-52s, Violent Femmes, Jewel, Huey Lewis, Modern English, and more. To keep the music flowing, we'll be sprinkling in classic episodes from our archives between each new one. So check out The Story Behind the Song wherever you get your podcast.
Hello, and welcome to Long Time No See, the podcast. Each week, we'll be pairing two blindfolded comedians who've agreed to sit down with a mystery guest. I'll be putting them on the spot with a series of questions about their careers, lives, and opinions. Without further ado, please remove your blindfolds and introduce yourself.
Hey, I'm Michael.
Hi, Andrea.
I have to be honest with you, I am so relieved to see a Jew.
Do you have any irrational fears? What's the worst fad you were into? Is there any job that you would be terrible at?
Underwater welder?
Don't say that about yourself.
Do you guys have any useless talents?
I kicked one of those delivery robots.
What? You kicked one?
Yelling. I kick those all the time.
They have names on them.
Good.
I can make smoke come out of my mouth with nothing.
Do it.
You want to see it?
What the f***? Are you a dragon?
Out now, Long Time No See, the podcast, season 2. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Welcome to Going There, the crossroads where music and mental health meet. This season of Going There is brought to you by Johnson & Johnson, who believe that health is everything. Their strength in healthcare innovation empowers them to build a world where complex diseases are prevented, treated, and cured. Where treatments are smarter and less invasive, and solutions are personal. Through their expertise in innovative medicine and medtech, they are uniquely positioned to innovate across the full spectrum of healthcare solutions today to deliver the breakthroughs of tomorrow and profoundly impact health for humanity. Learn more at www.jnj.com, at Janssen US, and at JNJINNOVMED on Twitter. Today we are talking with Charity Rose and Kenny Hensley of the indie folk band The Head and the Heart. You may know The Head and the Heart from their singles Rivers and Roads, Another Story, and Lost in My Mind. They have a new album out called Aperture, including their single Time with My Sins. The album has been described as having a warm, handcrafted sound and collaborative spirit. They have a North American tour coming up that starts end of May and goes all the way through October. So check out The Head and the Heart's music, tour info, and merch at theheadandtheheart.com. Now, on the Going There podcast, we have the tough conversations to address important issues so we can learn from each other, challenge the stigma of mental illness, and get the care we need. And one topic that we discuss with Charity and Kenny is the concept of having what they described in a previous interview as a welcoming energy. Now, when we say welcoming energy, we generally mean openness, acceptance, and even an embrace of a range of people, ideas, emotions, and situations. And welcoming energy is very important when working in the context of a band. Not only do we need to be open to different ideas, but also we need that welcoming energy to build chemistry within a band or in a music scene. And in previous interviews, the band described how Seattle, which is where the band was formed, had that welcoming energy, and that was critical to giving the band its start. Now, just as a welcoming energy is important for our creative endeavors, it is also important for our mental health. We want to be open to and accepting of new ideas, emotions, people, and situations that might improve our mental health and well-being. The issue is that when most of us think of welcoming energy in our mental health, we think about being open to more positive things, positive thoughts, good moods, and people and situations that make us feel like our best selves. And these positive experiences are, of course, extremely valuable to building strong mental health and a community that supports us. But something that can be more difficult but equally important to our mental health is having a welcoming energy for thoughts, feelings, and behaviors that are not necessarily positive or comfortable. When we feel anxious, depressed, angry, or hopeless, when we engage in behaviors that we think are not healthy or counterproductive to our goals in life, or even when we engage with people that we might be drawn to, but are toxic to us in some way. It's in these moments that our welcoming energy does not necessarily mean that we like or will accept or foster those experiences, but rather that we will welcome the opportunity to learn about ourselves from those more difficult experiences, to understand why we feel the way we feel or do the things that we do, to better understand our needs, and ultimately how to find alternatives that address those needs. And the Head and the Heart talk about doing just that, both in terms of their band and their individual mental health. They actually sought group therapy as a band to deal with some of the issues they were facing, including former member Josiah Johnson's struggle with addiction and ultimate exit from the band. And Kenny talks about his own struggle with addiction and how he needed to embrace a welcoming energy to understand and manage his addiction to alcohol and prescription medication. Now, as we progress through this season of Going There, our goal is to bring you, the audience, further into the conversation. We'd love to hear your feedback, questions you have that have been sparked by our conversations with these incredible artists, and topics you'd love to see addressed. If you enjoy the show, please leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. These help other folks find their way into the conversation so they can go there with us. So let's go there and listen to what Charity and Kenny have to say. So one of the things I wanted to start with was, and we talked about this a little bit before the episode, and again, I don't know who said it, but I feel as though someone in your band described the Seattle scene where you guys originally met as having a strong welcoming energy. And that concept is so important, both creatively, socially, but also in terms of our mental health, because generally speaking, we are not very open and not very welcoming to our mental health experiences, just as many scenes are not particularly open and welcoming of new musicians. And so what I'd love to do is just talk about that concept in terms of your guys' creative journey and then also in terms of your mental health journey. So let's start there.
I'm born and raised Seattle, so I'm curious to hear Kenny's perspective, you know, of the LA scene. But I wasn't, you know, playing out and as a musician really until I came back from university, and then 2 weeks later met everyone in the, you know, formed the Head and the Heart at the open mic. And so, but you know, the early trajectory, early days of the band, it was just, it felt like there wasn't this competitive, like there's a healthy competition, of course, between acts and everything, but there's a very communal space, like specifically with Connor Byrne Open Mic, where we played, you know, and refined a lot of our songs. An incredible stage to just, you know, connect and commune with other musicians, learn, collaborate, like, and, you know, there's just happened to be, you know, like I'm just thinking of so many different, you know, like a booking agency being so supportive and you know, the head of this little mini music festival that we played on Orcas Island, you know, is like so philanthropic and supportive of artists and musicians who are, you know, just trying to make it. And, you know, which from the perspective of some other people in the band who came from the East Coast, you know, like they always said it was such a huge contrast and they couldn't believe it. And they're even skeptical a bit of this scene. And, you know, we just happened to fall into this, the most incredible, you know, really, yeah, welcoming community. And everyone wanted to really support one another versus saying, you know, if I make it, you won't. And kind of competitive mentality, critical mentality. But yeah, I'm curious to hear your perspective, Kenny, being from LA.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty wild for me growing up in Los Angeles. And this is my first band. I like music for me through my high school years became my greatest passion and my greatest love as far as, you know, art that I would like making and what I would like to do in the future. But I was really insecure about the idea of showing that to anybody, you know, like none of my friends knew I played music. Really the only people in the world that knew I even dabbled were, you know, my sister and my parents, cause they would hear me at home. And I just, it wasn't in my world out of my parents' house. But it was my greatest passion. And LA is just such a tough, it's so big, there's so many people, there's so many fake people, you really never know what you're going to get. And I went to a ton of shows, but I never really met anybody my age who wanted to make the same type of music I did, who inspired me. And so I was always kind of searching. After high school, I traveled a ton and was just looking for something that would hopefully kickstart what ended up being a music career. But yeah, I saw, like, to be honest, I saw Fleet Foxes on SNL, and I loved Sub Pop Records already. They were my favorite record label. All the bands on Sub Pop I loved, and had been to Seattle one time for like 6 hours and just thought the idea of Seattle was cool. I loved the grunge history. And I had left home a couple times already just searching for something, and that was kind of just my next move. I went up there completely just alone, hoping I could find something, and in a way kind of thinking this is my chance before I get too old and have to commit to going to school and getting a real career. This is my chance to go somewhere that's not home, so I feel comfortable and there's nothing tied to it, and in a place I can be vulnerable and try this out for the first time. And I moved up to Seattle, and it blew me away. I mean, within 2 weeks, I was at open mic nights where there was like this community of people and these bands and meeting people that are musicians. And it was like everywhere you went, there were shows happening and bands performing, and they were all of this community that was just so different than what I was used to at home. And, you know, I went from never having performed in front of a person in my entire life and never being in a band to moving up there, and within 3 or 4 weeks was playing at open mic nights with John and Josiah every week and writing with them every single day. And it just became this thing. It was incredibly welcoming in a lot of ways. And I think if it wasn't for that, I probably quickly would have turned around and headed home after 6 months or something. I would have, you know, tried it out for a little bit. But because there was this energy in the city, and it was just so exciting to be, not only to witness, but then to quickly become a part of it, it was addicting. It was amazing.
It's interesting. One of the things that you guys talked about, the concept of competition, if I win, you don't, which I actually want to get to a little bit later in terms of mental health. But my impression as an outsider, and, you know, I was already an adult during the late 80s, early 90s, but, you know, still high school, college. And the impression I got, especially about the Seattle scene, was that that as different bands started to become known, it actually lifted up the prominence of everybody. That's what it seemed from the outside, is like the idea that there was all of these different bands and people who were influenced by certain bands. So if, you know, Nirvana, then people became more aware of the Melvins, or with Pearl Jam, people became aware of Green River and, you know, Mudhoney and things like that. And so it seemed from an outsider's perspective that the idea would be, especially within the context of a scene, look, if any of us make it, it's better for everybody involved. But is that true? Is that just sort of a kind of an idealistic outsider's perspective?
You know, that's interesting. I was a little too young. I was, you know, born in the mid 80s to, you know, and I didn't have older siblings to kind of turn me on to like the grunge era. But, you know, I'm like a fan now, and look, knowing the history, and Maddie and the band and Chris, you know, grew up in Seattle, and they're a little older and kind of, you know, grew up, you know, with that being integral to their kind of musical formation. And so, yeah, I mean, understanding the history, yeah, very much applied that then, and it applied kind of to our era as well. Like Fleet Foxes had kind of, you know, they had come up just before, as far as like bursting onto the national and international scene, just before us. And then I remember they were kind of a very different genre, but Macklemore and Ryan Lewis at the time, you know, were also paralleling around the same time. And you know, and there's so many bands that, you know, like we would take other bands out and we would be taken out, you know, by local acts. And like even Dave Matthews was a mentor to us early on. And he, you know, splits his time between Seattle and Virginia. And, you know, and I feel like he's always kind of, you know, taken young bands under his wing. And he had such amazing advice. And he also kind of showed us the outline of having like the importance of having a kind of democratic band. And his advice was just stick together, you know? And, so I think that, yeah, there is such a, like, I think it's totally, totally, you know, applies to our scene, and it's still happening. There's still, you know, other artists in the scene now that are coming up and exploding, and Sierra Farrell, and, you know, there's, the Broody Brothers, she's taking them out, and they kind of met, busking in Pike Place, like, which we did, you know, a decade, you know, and a half before that. And, you know, so I think it's an incredible thing to see that support kind of infrastructure, that none of us really were expecting or going into it really realizing, even present enough to realize, because it felt so quick and such a blur in hindsight. Also, you know, I guess the antithesis of that, you know, we also felt it with just wanting to kind of play shows as much as possible and with as many artists and collaborate as much as we could.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious, and maybe Kenny, if coming from LA, because so let's take as an assumption here that there is an awareness that the cooperation between artists, between bands, that there has been a long history in music of establishing that cooperating tends to work pretty well for all the reasons, you know, Charity, that you just described. And yet there still is this sort of sense of competition. And so I'm kind of curious from your guys' perspective, like, where does that come from, or how does that get in somebody's heart? You know, like, to all of a sudden, instead of being like, no, I don't necessarily want to cry, but it's like, we're going to the top and nobody else can, or, you know, we're going to elbow people out of the way.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if I've ever felt that, in Seattle, there was much more, kind of community and helping each other and building each other up than I was used to. And I know for sure than the East Coast guys were used to, especially, you know, they came over and they're like, wow, why is everybody so nice? And why is everybody so friendly? And almost thinking it can't be real because, you know, that's not real, the real world. Yeah. It was pretty jarring, not jarring, but, unexpected and different for me to kind of get used to that. And I think as you grow as a band and more opportunity comes up and other bands, you know, grow and you see some bands, you know, surpass what you've ever done, I think that it's only natural to feel some sort of like, oh, I wish we had that too, you know, or, and I'm sure other bands have thought the same thing about us, which I guess you could chalk up to competitive nature. But at the end of the day, like Charity said early on, it was, and still to this day, it's how often can we take out friends' bands in Seattle that haven't had any exposure and that we know are good enough to make it? It's like, we know that there's a million bands out there that are writing songs and doing things that are good enough to at least garner some attention and make somewhat of a living doing this, you know, but not everybody's getting that chance. And just trying our best to, like, expose our friends and our peers and do that in any way possible, I think, was really important to us and has always been. But yeah, of course, a little healthy competition is not a bad thing.
Well, you know, and with that, one of the things that you guys have also talked about before is the idea of the delicate nature of chemistry within a band, right? Because in the same way that between artists or between different bands, there can be that competition or that welcoming energy, sometimes even within a band, it can be very difficult to balance that, because on the one hand, you could argue that a competitive nature can bring out a certain spark and a certain energy. And, you know, people are trying to, you know, they want their songs on the album, they want to be good enough, or they want people to like it. But on the other hand, obviously that can get to the point where it's no longer welcoming. It's no longer that collaborative vibe. And I'm just kind of curious what your guys' experiences have been with that, and in terms of just band chemistry.
I mean, I think it's really a forever dance in any group dynamic, you know, and especially with a creative group, it's like, where it's, you know, it's kind of a requirement to be extra vulnerable and therefore have kind of, you know, trust within each other and the system. And if there's a breakdown of that, then there's, in my mind, a breakdown of true authentic creative output as a group, and it's going to be dysfunctional and lopsided, and what you create not necessarily exemplative of a representative of everyone there. And so I think that's a forever dance, and yeah, it's true. It's like having that healthy competition, you know, within a group. And that's that, you know, the uniqueness of this band is we have, you know, it's not just one singer songwriter. We have multiple singers, multiple songwriters. We're all producers. And And so I think it's really like, if we're all firing on all cylinders, then, you know, there's like this healthy competition. But it's true that can, you know, if you become too critical internally, you know, of one another, or too competitive, you know, to the extreme, like you're saying, like, then it can be stifling to the process and stifling to the creativity. And then it's no longer, you know, this safe space to create. It's like, we all met, and with the exception of Tyler and John, no one knew each other. We all met at this open mic, you know, like, Chris was the last to join, and he was the bass player of the open mic watching us.
The bartender.
Sorry. The bartender of the open mic. He didn't even play bass. And he's like, I can learn bass, you know, I'll join. You know, so it's just like, we're this ragtag team of people coming from different parts of the country, have, you know, didn't really know each other. So have, you know, have different backgrounds and modes of communication. And so we didn't really, we got to know each other as we were, you know, on this upward trajectory of, as a band, and really saying yes to everything and not, you know, allowing for breaks at all, or rest, you know, on an extreme. So it took us a while, and then we were kind of learning each other as we went, you know, and then there was a major shakeup in the band, and just with a person who was dealing with addiction, and he had to step away. And so then there's like a reaction to that within the band. But, you know, I think my point is that the relationships in our band, we're now to a point, or we got to a point where we decided that we, you know, wanted to work with like a group therapist. And she, her background is in trauma and PTSD and such, and working with musicians as well. And you know, so we really like needed that support, I guess, relationally, to kind of get back to this healthy place, so that then in turn, we could be creative, and, you know, as an extension of kind of healthy relationships, as we finally got to know each other, and you know, in the midst of this chaos, really, this excitement, you know, that was happening around the band. But it was quite a journey for us. It's been quite a journey, you know? And so I think with this record specifically, in many ways, we were calling it, you know, we wanted to call it The Head and the Heart Too, or like, this is our rebirth as a band. Because we got to this place where relationally creatively, like, we're at this place where the process of us coming together is in many ways the art itself. And we trust, in trusting the process, we know that we're going to create amazing art that is authentic representation of the intense, you know, fire and magic and chemistry between us. Let's set up a mic. Let's strip back any extra production and see what happens.
The trust that you have in a band, the welcoming energy, right? One of the reasons why people often don't have welcoming energy is because they're afraid that if they are vulnerable, they'll be vulnerable to good things like open, you know, to ideas, et cetera, but they'll also be vulnerable to being hurt. And what, even the thing that you guys were talking about before, the reason why we're often not welcoming of our mental health issues, like, for example, like things that people don't enjoy as much, like anger or anxiety or depression, is because we feel that there's a competition between that and happiness, fulfillment, you know, excitement, that if we feel those more quote unquote negative feelings, we won't feel the positive feelings. So it's almost like this little competitive war. And on the one hand, it's good to sort of try, if you want to think of it competitively, to feel good, you know, to almost look at each day and be like, well, how can I feel good today and whatever. But to some degree, if it's done antagonistically, it doesn't tend to work, because we need to kind of understand and take care of our negative feelings as much as our positive feelings. And that can work internally to some degree, but interpersonally, sometimes it can be very difficult to say, well, I'm totally welcoming and open to a situation that is causing me harm. And I guess I'm, you know, and so it's sort of like that question of, well, when are you being welcoming and understanding and accepting? And is that a good thing in a relationship? And when does it turn into, okay, this is just too toxic, and it wasn't intentionally a competition, but I've lost. Like, the toxicity has basically overtaken any of the good stuff. And so I'm kind of curious from your perspective, it sounds like there was some kind of journey with that, in terms of, especially if you're dealing with someone with addiction or within a band.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, even going back, I think just us meeting was a miracle, and us getting through the first 5-6 years, especially, was a miracle. I think, like Charity touched on, like, we didn't really know each other. And now looking back, I know that all of us have very different personalities and pretty strong personalities in a lot of ways, for better or worse. I think that's what does, when it's clicking, what does make what we do and what we produce unique and different. But yeah, it's a constant dance and a constant bending. And I'm not married, but I assume it's in a lot of ways maybe even tougher than a marriage, because you're with 5 other people and you're working creatively, which is such a deep personal thing. At least for me, it is. You know, it's like it feels like, you know, your creative work, you know, is your soul. And if other people are too critical right off the bat, it can really hurt, you know, and it can be crushing. And it's taken me learning how to be okay and to let things go and to know that it is this back and forth, and that everybody's feeling emotions and everybody's feeling these things to some extent.
One of the things that can happen with where something, for some people, where something just gets stuck, meaning like it's no longer kind of a system where you're interacting with yourself and you're interacting with the world. It like kind of has a life of its own, and it's no longer sensitive to things that are happening internally, externally. And addiction, as an example, can often be like that. You know, at some point, using is something that is connected to, you know, maybe you're going out and having fun, or you're trying to relax, or you're just trying to connect with someone. And then at some point, it just has a life of its own where you're just feeding that addiction. And when that happens, oftentimes the sense of welcoming that may have been easier with a person who is struggling with addiction can just be more difficult, because you almost feel like, okay, like something is different about the way we're connecting here. You're not as tuned into me. Your mind is somewhere else. Your body is somewhere else. Your spirit is somewhere else. And when that happens, oftentimes no one says, hey, just by the way, I'm addicted right now, and so I just want to let you know I might be a little bit off. It tends to happen slowly, and it takes a long time for even the person to know. And so I'm kind of just curious if you guys feel comfortable talking about it, just what that process was like for you to kind of discover, like, hey, someone in the band is kind of struggling with this issue, and how it's affecting them and how it's affecting everybody else.
Yeah, I mean, we dealt with Josiah, who was one of the founding, you know, first members of the band after our in between our second and third record, so 2013-14, those kind of years, I think. Things changed. We didn't really know exactly what it was. Long story short, he had some addiction issues, and they had to be dealt with, and so he had to leave the band and, you know, go to treatment. And that was kind of in the middle of recording our third record, first time working with a producer, kind of a first time a major label's, you know, breathing down our necks, wanting us to produce and come out with a great record and great songs, and dealing with this at the same time was really tough, but at the same time, just really wanting him to be okay and healthy and be alive, and wanting him to get the help he needed. So we went through all that. And then, I mean, I also was the other member in the band that had the same deal happen. You know, it was only 3 years ago. I was in rehab for a month and got to a point, kind of assisted and pushed by the pandemic, and I had a couple shoulder surgeries that then led to like self-medicating, and I'm not working and I'm medicating. And then all of a sudden you're so deep into it that you can't get out. And, you know, I had to leave the band for a while, and it's still one of those things that's really tough to think about and to remember. But that gives me all the motivation in the world to just do the opposite. And I can like happily say that the last year or two of my life have been night and day different and better, and I have no reason to go back to any of that. So yeah, I mean, I've personally experienced what it's like to be in this band when somebody else is going through that, and how hard it can be just to keep the ship afloat and to keep moving and to keep going, doing our job and producing music and hopefully music that the world likes and makes them feel good when you're deep down, like, dealing with this turmoil. And I've also experienced being on the other side of it and all the just the intense regret and, like, how could I let this go? How could I be such a, you know, piece of crap that I, like, couldn't keep this under control and, like, be more professional and, like, you know, just all sorts of guilt. And yeah, so I have, the odd experience of having experienced both of those. And luckily could say that things have been a lot better last while. But yeah, I'm curious to hear what Charity has to say because she's experienced it twice, both from the outside looking in.
With musicians, like, the level of alcoholism and addiction is so high. You know, being a musician, it's like, I understand, you know, it's like when you're first starting out, a lot of times you're barely getting paid. Sometimes you're just really getting paid in, like, drink tickets, for example, like raffle tickets.
Literally getting paid in alcohol.
That a dive bar is giving you, and you're like, I'm exhausted. Maybe we had arguments, you know, with somebody in the band, but we don't have time because we have to schlep our gear and sound check, and, you know, we'll brush it under the rug. I'll escape through these free drinks and I'll feel better for a little bit. And rinse and repeat, you know, and it's like, you know, and also you're sharing so much space, especially when you're van touring, you know, the more like punk rock approach to touring and you're not in a bus, you know, and then you, like, never have personal space and you're away from home. Where is your home? You know, then it's like, how do you escape? You know, how do you get that personal space if you physically have to be next to other people? And, you know, and you're so grateful and so open to the unexpected, and you want to say yes to everything, and you want to make it, you want to be able to do, you know, make a living doing your passion, that, you know, there isn't really a playbook, you know, with guardrails, and there's not a social system, you know, it's like, in my mind, you know, I have a great vision one day where it's like there can be some kind of socialist arm to labels that are helping to create, you know, long-term sustainability and health for artists that are creating these healthy boundaries, you know, versus just as if they're a cog, you know, and also for crew members, you know, like there's a whole nother, I don't know, you know, if you've, you know, interviewed many, you know, crew people, but it's like they even have, you know, a different type of or less ownership over the project, and they're independently coming in, and you know, it's like, it's just, and there's no real support, that's there's no structural support, and so it's like, I get why there's a high, you know, and you're so, you know, all of us, you know, artists are just so ripe for you know, we've got a lot of Pisces in our band, I guess. You know, just for, you know, sensitive to the surrounding. And if we aren't orienting and grounding and taking care of ourselves, which you aren't even thinking about when you're just trying to chase the excitement of the, you know, of it all. And things are changing. And like your podcast, you know, is incredible. And but it is such an interesting, tricky thing of it's a weird job. And there's not a real great playbook. And there's not, you know, social support. It's like they're all contract workers, you know?
Yeah, and it can be, I mean, also one more thing too, is just the performance aspect. You know, you get so used to, especially in the early days, like, oh, like I'm exhausted. I haven't been home in 2 months. I'm lonely in a way, even though you're around people all the time, because it's just the same people. You miss all your other people in your life. You feel like you're missing weddings and birthdays and whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. And so you're kind of just a lot of the time wishing you were home, and then you have to get up on stage every night. And what's the best way to kind of wake up is have a couple drinks before, have a couple during, and then you get off stage and you're full of adrenaline because you just performed in front of a bunch of people. And you know, you don't have to do anything till 3 p.m. the next day when you sound check, and you can sleep in if you want. So like, why not just go out to the bars and stay up till bars close and then crash and wake up hungover and do it all over again. And that was years, you know, maybe not every single night, but frequently enough, most nights on tour, for me, for the longest time, tour was, I almost started dreading going on tour just because I knew how crappy I'd feel the whole time. And when I was home, it was my chance to make up for it. I would get home and I wouldn't drink for a month, and I would go to the gym and work out and try to like get healthy to prep myself for tour again, which would be the downturn, you know. And we're so lucky. It's such an interesting, different life than so many people get to experience. We get to travel the country and the world and, you know, see so much and so much culture and meet so many people. And there's so much good about it. And just doing art for, you know, our careers is incredible when you look at it on paper. But there are a lot of things that come with it that you don't really think about when you're younger and you're dreaming about it. And, you know, once you're in the middle of it, you're just like, wow, this is crazy.
You feel so, so lucky, you know, to have gotten to this place that you don't want to talk about those realities. You know, it's like when you're at a, you know, family, I remember holidays, we'd come and you'd see the extended family. They'd ask, oh, how's the, you know, how is everything? How's the band? How's tour?
That's like the last thing you want to talk about.
And it's like, we're so lucky. Like, I don't even want to, you know, I feel like I can't begin to talk about the struggles, the mental struggles, you know, because in my mind, you know, it's warped. You think, oh, well, that would mean that I'm not, you know, appreciative of what we get to do. And so I think there's that kind of that mental exercise, you know, that mental, I don't know, that contrast that we kind of go through a little bit.
It's so true. Yeah. I feel like for the longest time, and I still struggle with it sometimes, you know, it's a good example of a family reunion or just visiting my family or close friends. You know, it's almost always one of the first things anybody asks you is, oh, so how's the band, or how was the tour, or how are the new songs coming along? And, you know, as grateful as I am to be in the position, you know, when it does control so much of your thinking and your mind, and then you're removed from it, it's sometimes like the last thing you want to talk about. But, and also, like Charity said, it's like you don't want to, like, what I want to talk about are the hard things, because I want to get through it. I want to process those things, and I want to learn to process those things. But you can't be the one talking about the negative things, because then you just look like an asshole for not being like, you know, you're living the dream, man, you're touring the world and you're doing this and that. Like, how could you only want to talk about the negative stuff? But those are the things that you have to talk about, because it's really, really tough to process anything when you're moving so quickly and you're moving in this group of very different personalities and all these other people that are our crew. And it's just going and going and going. And you rarely have a moment to stop and reset, you know, especially as a group. And so, yeah, it's wild.
And Kenny, one of the things that you, you know, talked about was just how badly it feels like, how could I do this? And it was interesting because we had on the podcast with Nikki Six of Motley Crue, I think was just one of the absolute best advocates for, you know, struggling with addiction. And he does something when he gives talks, you know, he goes talk to people about addiction, is the first thing he says, it's like, let's talk about what's great about drugs and alcohol. Mm-hmm. You know, let's talk about why, because the story that you told, right, is so, I think, common for people. Everyone assumes that addiction comes from this horrible darkness and it's a reflection of that. But oftentimes it comes just like you said. It's like you're doing it and you're trying to, yeah, you're having fun and it's no big deal. And then all of a sudden, you know, you're drinking tonight, and then all of a sudden it's like, hey, I'll have a beer in the morning. And that beer in the morning isn't because you're depressed or you're angry or whatever. It's just like, you know, maybe you're still having fun, maybe you're a little bit tired.
Or it'll fix the hangover or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe a beer. Oftentimes, not all the time, but oftentimes the darkness comes from once the addiction's taken hold. And it's something that I think, then again, with this concept of this welcoming energy, is that if you're not like kind of trying to listen to, well, okay, before I condemn myself for my addiction or for my using or whatever, well, what was I getting from that? You know, why did that make sense? Because, you know, if you don't do that, giving that up is going to be so difficult, because your body and your mind are saying, and your spirit are saying, like, hey, wait, we were getting a lot from that. You can't just take that away just because there's some bad stuff. And eventually you sort of have to do it that way, because oftentimes people stop just because they know they have to stop before they figured all of that out. But I think one of the most unfortunate things is, like, when people, like you said, it's like, well, like, how could I let this happen? And, you know, when you listen to the stories that you guys are telling, the question is like, how does anybody who's a musician not let that happen?
Totally.
I mean, considering like, you know, I argue you put any human being where they have to spend hours and hours and hours working on music, recording without necessarily having a set schedule, not necessarily getting sleep, being on a bus with, you know, other people, not necessarily having contact as much with, you know, people, not having, you know, having time to exercise, on and on and on. The pressure, people offering you drinks, people offering drugs.
Yeah, there's booze in your face at all times. You know, it's almost encouraged to do it on the job. Like, oh, it's a show. Everybody drinks, you know?
Right. And then, and all the things that it accomplishes, right? All the things that you guys talked about, like, you know, if physical pain, it takes care of that. It numbs you out. It's something that everybody's doing. So you want to, for the brief time that you can socialize, on and on and on, you can think of so many different things. And I sort of feel like it's, people are so quick to condemn themselves that it's sort of like, wait a minute, like, it, yes, like once the addiction takes hold, it's got its own set of problems. But if you lose sight of that, again, that's why this concept of welcoming energy with mental health is so, for me, is so important. That's why it resonated when you guys said it, is because I feel like people just all of a sudden, because like they just don't have that for themselves anymore. They're not open to themselves. They're just constantly berating. How could I let that happen? This is horrible. I'm such a horrible person. It's just like, man, it's just not kind, you know what I mean? You can almost guarantee like you wouldn't talk to somebody else like that, you know,
no, totally.
But we talk to ourselves in that way. And it's just, you know, I don't know. I think a lot of people have that story like you did where it made sense. It makes sense until it doesn't, unfortunately.
Yeah. I think for me, it's like I had tiptoed this line for so long, just being in this culture and being a musician, a touring musician, where there's a lot of drinking, a lot of partying. And, I feel like I had always kind of tiptoed the line of it never being a problem, you know, it never affecting my life outside of just feeling like crap and whatnot. And I was still like doing the work and still okay around my family. And I guess maybe I prided myself on being able to do that. It was like, I'm not like the other people who can't handle it. I can just do this forever. And then all of a sudden it happened so quickly, you know, and for me, like I said, it wasn't like, drinking never got so out of hand that I, you know, couldn't quit and I would never have like withdrawals or anything. It's like I could stop and start that. But then, you know, COVID happened and I had two shoulder surgeries from two different like freak accidents, just like random things I had to get taken care of. And because we had all this time off because of COVID, I did it. You know, they were surgeries I would have done earlier, but I couldn't because we toured a lot and it just would, you know, I never had the time. And I finally just did them. Or did one of them, and then I hurt the other one, had to have a second surgery. And then you're on medication, and you're not working. And, you know, looking back, it's like I knew what I was doing. I knew when I was upping the dose because I needed the same effect that was probably a slippery slope. But I also was like, we're not doing anything. Like, you know, I'll make sure I'm good by the time we're busy. And then you find yourself, you know, 6 months later, like completely dependent on this stuff. And you find yourself going on the dark web to buy drugs because you can't get enough from your doctor. And like, who knows what the hell is coming in, you know, in the drugs you're taking, you know, you don't even know if they're what you think they are. And just, it's just such a slippery slope. And then it's so terrifying because at that point, for me at least, like all I wanted was to get it out of me. You know, all I wanted was to go back to normal. So I wasn't like dependent on this thing. But I knew that the second I stopped taking this, a sickness is going to come upon me that's going to, you know, feel like I'm absolutely dying and like the worst anxiety I've ever felt in my entire life. And the only way to avoid that is to keep taking it. And, you know, it was such a scary like trap to be in and feel in. And when I finally did like quit cold turkey, you know, I ended up having a seizure and being found on my kitchen floor with blood pooling up under my head and ambulance came and like, I could have died, you know, and it's just insane that it got to that point. And thank God I didn't. And, you know, and that was the end of it for me. And now looking back, I'm just like, I can't imagine going back to that, but it was such a trip to go be in this band for, at the time, 13 years, and to have these years and years of like social drinking and maybe drinking too much and dabbling with other things and just being generally unhealthy, but never really calling yourself an addict. And then all of a sudden you're completely hooked on this thing you never thought you'd be hooked on, you know, not even the drugs that, you know, or the drug of choice or the alcohol or whatever, you know, has always been around us. And I don't know. Yeah, looking back, it's like I'm in a way glad I went through it all, because it was enough to kind of wake me up and realize that's something I never want to go through again. And yeah, and just, I don't know, going through a tough thing reset my brain in a way that I don't think I would have gotten otherwise. So, yeah.
You know, and so one of the things I want to just pivot to is that for a lot of people, as they struggle with these different things, there's two things that people do. And sometimes, and when we're musicians, people often do both of them. The first thing is that there's art and music out there that they use to cope. And then there's the music that they make in some ways to reflect or to cope. And so I wanted to just start with, for you guys individually or as a band, are there any songs, artists, albums that you really, you know, you really kind of are like, okay, when I'm in a tough place, or maybe not even a tough place, when I'm in a good place, but I know the good place might, you know, kind of lead me to a bad place, that it's like, these are my go-to, this is my go-to music, if you will.
Yeah. I mean, I think real quick, that kind of brings up just a thought that I think is worth saying, and then I'll get to the actual answer. But the idea that that art or music can be your escape and your therapy, you know, for me at least, that was completely what it was before this band. Like I said, I did it. It was something I did in my bedroom and was kind of like my secret. I didn't tell any of my friends I did it, but it was completely my greatest escape. I loved it to death because it relaxed me. It calmed my anxiety. It was a way to shut off my brain. And then I moved to Seattle and this band starts, and then you find yourself kind of losing that in a way, because then it becomes a job. And then this thing that you had, this like tool you had to escape these, like this horrible anxiety and whatever you may be feeling, is gone, because that's now your job and it's connected to a lot of stress and a lot of exhaustion. And so I had to really find just new ways. And you see that with other people, you know, whether it's Mike Tyson and his pigeons or who is it that paints, like, not Robin Williams, but one of the big comedic actors is like, oh, Jim Carrey. Painting, you know, it's like they, like, I'm sure there's some similarities there where it's like they had this art and this thing that was their greatest passion and it was an escape for them. And then when you connect that to all these stressors and all these things, you kind of do lose that and you have to find something else. And I mean, I'm a serial hobbyist. It's like I have a new hobby every 6 months, but I think it's really important. And I think for any musicians, especially out there listening, just trying your best to find a couple sources of escape outside of music, I think is so, so important and has really saved me in a lot of ways.
I think that's a super important thing that actually nobody has said on the podcast before, which I think it's a really interesting insight. The when music, if it's something that's professional, it might lose that space a little bit, which is both good in the sense that it's wonderful that people are interested enough that it can be a profession, but it you know, it may lose that function. And to have something else, or for people to be aware of it, like, hey, why is this no longer, you know, feeling that way for me, is super important. Because people could probably get very upset by being like, wait, why is my music? But in terms of, let's go back a little bit to music that you guys listen to start, and then we'll talk about a song. Where do you guys turn when you're struggling?
It's interesting. I think I grew up listening to classical music, thanks to my mom, who's a retired orchestra teacher and violinist, violist. And so maybe there's a comfort, you know, kind of subconscious comfort there. This is, you know, upbringing. But so some of my go-tos, you know, I also think because there aren't lyrics, there's such a, like, you know, broad feeling about towards them, and I can kind of get enveloped in them, you know, how, you know, according to my perspective, and specifically, I would say that a couple of my go-tos would be, you know, a very famous Claude Debussy's Clair de Lune, and also from Carnival of the Animals, the Swan Song by Camille Saint-Saëns, which I just feel like, you know, the arc of, for example, the arc of Clair de Lune, it's just anytime I can feel like I'm going on an arc, or I'm feeling both you know, sadness and grief and being led through that. And then you come out on the other side and there's joy. It's like happy tears. For me, like my favorite songs give me happy tears, which feels like it's these contrasting emotions, right? But it's like that duality is something that I live for hearing, because it just, it feels like it gets to the deepest part of who I am emotionally, and thus is cathartic. But I also, whenever maybe I'm amazed by Paul McCartney comes on, I freaking, you know, any kind of like longing, if there's a longingness that I hear, you know, and like a pushing through it resilience, and, you know, it's just the complexity of those emotions that feels, that's also cathartic kind of go-tos.
Do you guys have a song that you did that you feel like best represents your mental health journey, either individually or as a band?
Totally. Yeah. I guess my response to your question, the first one was, I feel like when we're not actively doing music or like on the road in the studio, I find myself, and this kind of happened maybe 2-3 years into the band, just not listening to a ton of music for better or worse. Before this band, it was all I wanted to do was absorb as much as possible and find as many artists as I could. And I really like, you know, loved doing that. I think now, and it's again connected to what I said about, you know, it being this kind of escape for me, and then losing that escape, I feel like now it's just attached to so many things that I don't always find myself wanting to listen to new music. But like Charity said, a lot of instrumental music, like Sigur Rós is a group I always go back to because I don't need to focus on the lyrics. It's just beautiful to me. I've always been more of a melody person anyways. Like I have a few of my favorite artists of all time. It's because of their lyrics, like Paul Simon and Dylan. But at the end of the day, I feel more from melody and composition than I do from anything on earth. And, you know, I listen to a lot of film scores, and, you know, even like the other day was listening to the Gettysburg soundtrack, you know, from like random movies. Like I like that. And I think also I before this band started, I thought that would be my avenue into music, was doing something like that, because I'm not much of a singer, and all the music I would write felt very kind of cinematic. And so I kind of thought, like, if I don't meet other people, I'll probably just try to get into that world. And maybe listening to that type of music still kind of brings me back to that kind of innocence of like, oh, there's still some things in music that I haven't done and that I would like to do in the future, even though we've done so much in the last 15, 16 years. But yeah, I go back to a lot of instrumental music, film scores, or my mom growing up. My dad introduced me to playing music. He was a guitar player and introduced me to the Beatles and a couple things that completely changed my life and my trajectory. But my mom, when I was a kid, was the neighborhood babysitter. And so before I was in kindergarten, it was me and 10 other kids every single day, just like going to the zoo, going to the museum, or hanging out at home, doing whatever. And my mom had these tapes that she would make called her Happy Songs tapes. And there were maybe 6 or 7 of them. And they were just a compilation of songs she loved. Everything from Simon and Garfunkel songs to Come On Eileen to whatever. And we listened to them so much in the years from like 1 to 4 or 5 that they're just ingrained in my brain as songs that make me feel good and feel young again. And whenever I hear any songs that were on those tapes, it's an immediate like warmth of just like, I feel comfortable and good. And so I find myself going back to a lot of that music too.
Can you list off a few more that you can think of?
Oh, like songs on them?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it was a lot of just, you know, like there were some ska songs because ska was really popular in the 90s.
Yeah.
Like Save Ferris did a cover of a song. A lot of old like Paul McCartney, Beatles songs, Neil Young, Simon and Garfunkel, Paul Simon, just like all the stuff that I really, really love, but just kind of their like class. She always liked pretty songs that felt happy too. Like she had like, you know, Me and Julio Down by the Schoolyard is like a big one that I, every time I hear, it brings me back to being 3 years old, sitting in a car seat in my mom's van and just like feeling good and thinking in the moment when I was 3, like, I like this. And this makes me feel happy. I want to do, like, understanding that music made me feel a certain way more than anything else did, even when I was 2 or 3, you know?
Yeah, well, we should pull it up, and I want to listen to that compilation, you know?
It's just good. Yeah, it's just good music, in my opinion, you know?
Totally.
Well, listen, guys, thank you so much for taking the time. It was great talking with you. You know, congratulations on all your success and you know, the things that you've been through personally and as a band. And really appreciate you sharing that, because there's so many people out there who are just sitting kind of feeling alone in it and knowing that they're, you know, their rock stars have been through it and are going through it and are human just makes such a difference. And so thank you so much for taking the time. Really appreciate it. And
oh, thanks for doing this. What an amazing podcast to be doing. So appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much.
So there it is. Charity and Kenny from the Head and the Heart discussing how welcoming energy is not only an approach they use in terms of creativity and band cohesion, but also as a way of managing mental health issues. Now, there's so much to take away from the conversation. But one thing I wanted to focus on was something that Kenny talked about towards the end of the discussion. He explained that whatever it is that we do for a profession, it is important that we have alternative activities that we enjoy that take us away from that professional work and help us cope with stress. Now, what was really important about what Kenny said is that part of welcoming energy is being willing to recognize that sometimes the function of something in our lives changes. So, for example, many of us embrace music because we love it. It is the escape from school, work, stress, whatever's going on in our lives. And very few of us are able to become professional musicians. But for the people who do become professional musicians, when the music becomes a job, its function in our life may change. It may become more rather than less stressful, and therefore not as much of a refuge for us to cope with the difficult things in our lives. Because the music as a job becomes the difficult thing. And we have to be open to that change so that we can adapt and find other strategies to decompress or cope. Similarly, Kenny described how he initially used alcohol and medication in part to manage stress. But as time went on and he developed addiction, he needed to be open to the idea that the function of the alcohol and the medication had changed for him. That it was no longer as constructive in reducing stress, but rather became the stress itself. And that openness was the key to his recovery, as well as for many of us who are willing to embrace that welcoming energy to be honest with ourselves about our mental health struggles. I want to thank Charity and Kenny for this wonderful conversation. This season of Going There is brought to you by Johnson & Johnson, who believes that health is everything. Their strength in healthcare innovation empowers them to build a world where complex diseases are prevented, treated, and cured, where treatments are smarter and less invasive, and solutions are personal. Through their expertise in innovative medicine and medtech, they are uniquely positioned to innovate across the full spectrum of healthcare solutions today to deliver the breakthroughs of tomorrow and profoundly impact health for humanity. Learn more at www.jnj.com, at Janssen US, and at JNJINNOVMED on Twitter. And I, of course, want to thank Consequence Podcast Network and SoundMind Live for including me in this wonderful project. And thanks to Pete Wilson and the Rooks for letting us use their song, I Know. If you are struggling with anxiety, depression, or addiction and are looking for help, please call the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration National Helpline at 1-800-622-4357. If you are thinking about harming yourself and want to seek help, please contact the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline at 988. You may also go to the SoundMind Live and Consequence websites for more information. So be healthy, be safe, and be kind to yourself and others. See you next time at the Crossroads.
Hi, this is James Mercer from The Shins.
This is Shirley Manson.
This is Lo Tullhurst, co-founder of The Cure.
This is Huey Lewis giving you the story behind the song.
The Story Behind the Song is back with an exciting second season. We peel back the layers on music's most iconic hits with legendary artists like The Killers, Heart, The B-52s, Violent Femmes, Jewel, Huey Lewis, Modern English, and more. To keep the music flowing, we'll be sprinkling in classic episodes from our archives between each new one. So check out The Story Behind the Song wherever you get your podcast.
Hey, Army and fellow music fans, I'm Kayla.
And I'm Bethany, and we're the hosts of Standing BTS from the Consequence Podcast Network. We're a bi-weekly show that covers the impact and legacy of K-pop group BTS.
We mix the perfect blend of research and fangirl as we take a deep dive into lyrics during album reviews, theorize over music videos, and keep up with their current events.
No BTS topic is off limits. We welcome everyone into the conversation, whether you're a casual fan, committed ARMY, or someone who's just curious about one of the biggest music groups in the world.
come chat with us every other Thursday with a new episode wherever podcasts are found.